And Andy phoned me up and said, do you fancy doing this Radiohead thing? I thought, yeah, massively. And so it was the time when faxes, you know, and I found it the other day, actually, because I was showing my son, because he was a massive Radiohead fan. Mm. And I showed this random part, and I looked at it and thought, I could see where it's... I could see it.
Who wrote the part? Johnny?
Johnny, yeah. It was on Logic. I think it was a Logic part. But it just had a couple of saxophones playing chords and the baritone, you know, doing what it does at the bottom.
Hi everyone, it's Chris Simpson from the Stage Left podcast. Welcome to our new episode. I'm recording this during lockdown, this intro. We actually recorded the episode with Steve like a day before lockdown, I think it was. And he came around to ours and it was a really interesting night because we had some nice food and then we recorded the interview and actually we got quite drunk because it was kind of that, you know, when lockdown first came and it was like, okay, so the world's going to be a very, very different place going forward. So let's just, you know, roll with it. And so we had a really good time, actually. Hopefully it comes across on the podcast. And there's loads of interesting stories, like the one where he's hanging out with Morgan Freeman and Tim Robbins from The Shawshank Redemption. And like stories of playing with Noel Gallagher, with Madness, Stevie Wonder, loads of good stuff in there. He's a top guy, Steve. And obviously recording with Radiohead, Kid A, amazing. Some really interesting stories around that as well. So yeah, it's been an interesting few weeks. Sorry you haven't heard from us. I actually had coronavirus myself for 2.5 weeks. I had the full kind of spectrum of symptoms, from like crazy muscle aching to like difficulty breathing. Luckily it never, in my case, came to something that was like super serious. But like an interesting story is that with my taste and smell going, it was like, it was absolutely fine. And then when I noticed it had gone, you know, within 2 hours of it being fine, I sprayed aftershave on the back of my hand twice and put the back of my hand to my nose and I couldn't smell anything. It's like zero, like I'd sprayed water. It was so weird. And it hasn't fully come back and it's a weird lingering thing. But thank you for all your messages because I did kind of mention it online and people kind of checking in that I'm okay and yeah, all good. And I hope you're kind of staying safe and well and connected where you are. A lot of the work I've been doing in the last few weeks has been around kind of supporting people's well-being. So I'm doing now kind of one-to-ones, if anybody's interested, kind of coaching sessions specifically around supporting people's well-being. If you are interested in that, you know, I'm a qualified mental health first aider, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, happy to support. So drop an email to stageleftnights@gmail.com. That's stageleftnights@gmail.com, where I can do kind of individual or group support if you want that. And you know, in regards to this episode, you know, if you're fans of Noel Gallagher, you know, Bonehead from Oasis in the last couple of weeks wrote an amazing tweet, couple of tweets actually, saying how much he loves the podcast. And so an email just came in saying how much he loves the podcast and how he's listened to Gem episodes and Christian Madden and that he wants to come on. So when things settle down, we're going to get him to come over and record it person to person. And other episodes we've had in the past, if you've never checked them out, Gem Archer, Russ Pritchard, Mikey Rowe, Jess and YC from Noel Gallagher's band. And the topic of YC, spoke to a couple of days ago, unfortunately, Tony Allen, the legendary Afrobeat drummer who she's been working with and she talked really passionately about when she came over to record the Stage Left podcast a couple of months ago. He passed away a couple of days ago. Now, if you listen back to that episode, you'll hear she did a cover of The Right Stuff by Noel Gallagher and Tony playing drums on that. And she'd been working with him on all the material. So it's a really sad day. Like, he's a total legend. He like invented a new type of drumming, essentially, or a new genre, actually, Afrobeat. So really, really sad to hear that he's passed. And our wishes go out to YC. Okay, so we hope you enjoy this episode. You know, hopefully this will take you away from what's going on in the world at the moment, whether you're on a run at the moment listening to this, whether you're at home, whether you're now back to work and you're listening to this on a commute and you're looking around kind of suspiciously at everybody on the train and, you know, checking that they're covering their mouths when they're coughing, etc. We're with you. Stay with us. And we hope you enjoy this. This is Steve Hamilton. Okay. Okay, welcome to the Stage Left podcast, lifting the veil on the music industry by telling the stories of those with a unique vantage point. The podcast exists to provide free educational content for young musicians entering an increasingly complex industry by telling the stories of some of the unsung heroes behind the success. Go to thestageleftpodcast.com for all episodes featuring musicians who discuss in detail the writing and performing processes with the likes of Elvis Presley, David Bowie, Michael Jackson, The Beatles, Fleetwood Mac, Nick Cave, Oasis, Morrissey, Alanis Morissette, The Damned, The 1975, Bob Dylan, The Stone Roses, Jeff Lynne and Kraftwerk. Our guest today is saxophonist and composer Steve Hamilton, who has had an incredible career touring Kid A and Amnesiac with Radiohead, and has played with the likes of Tina Turner, Stevie Wonder and Aretha Franklin. Today we'll be discussing Hamland, writing parts for Noel Gallagher's live shows and recent EPs, touring with Madness, recording the iconic brass parts on Radiohead's jazz mashup, the National Anthem. And as we record this on the 16th of March 2020, we'll also be discussing how coronavirus may impact the industry and livelihood of musicians. So it's a pleasure to say that our guest today on the Stage Left podcast is none other than Steve Hamilton. Thanks for joining us today, Steve. How's it going?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, I'm good.
Good stuff.
I'm alive.
You're alive. Well, that's a start at the moment, unfortunately. And I mean, on that subject, it's a bit of a weird atmosphere at the moment. So, like, you know, we say it's the 16th of March for listeners, and we feel like we're on the precipice of something very serious. And actually, Boris Johnson's literally just announced in the UK that a lot of bars and clubs and potentially live venues, it's recommended that people don't go to them. He hasn't cancelled them or shut them, but he said kind of recommended people don't go to them, which is leaving a lot of musicians in a very difficult position.
It's leaving pretty much everyone in exactly the same position, which is, in any way, it's not really a comfort that everyone is in the same situation, not only in this country, but throughout the world. Facebook is just awash with people who are saying, well, I'm doing my last gig for a while now. Anyone want to buy a trumpet? And it's a bit grim. But there is something vaguely comforting about the fact that everyone is in the same situation, because there are no gigs happening. I think it was Austria that said that they would only have events that were under five people, which is quite suitable for some jazz gigs that I've done in the past.
But all played to empty rooms.
I did actually do a gig where there were more people on stage. There was only a quartet as well. It's just the drummer didn't have a girlfriend, I think. So basically, it's a grim outlook. Every single day on the way here, you know, you mentioned the album that I've just written and recorded, Hamland. We were due to launch that on the 11th of April, and that was pulled due to the virus. Everything is no one's flying anywhere. It's mayhem, and you know it will have huge financial implications on that and the crew, touring musicians. I don't know. No one knows when it's going to stop, and if it indeed will.
Where does that kind of leave people? You know, is there other ways of making income out of this that you could foresee? You know, streaming gigs and stuff like that. But it's probably, I don't know if people.
Streaming gig. I think there was talk of doing one yesterday. A friend of mine was doing a gig at the Palladium, and it was a live broadcast, so they had to continue, but they were going to do it without an audience. I think the whole thing was pulled in the end, but. I mean, it's a very fluid situation, as they keep saying, and we've learned a whole new vocabulary of social distancing and self-isolating and stuff. I'm actually doing a session tomorrow at my house with the horn section, but I can see that being the last sort of thing for a fair few weeks, just because people aren't going to want to go out of their houses. And I think there's a sort of social responsibility that everyone will begin to feel more, that they cannot go out, you know, that protect everyone else. So yeah, it's grim, but it'll pass. When the virus peaks, hopefully things will begin to get back to normal.
I mean, how do you feel? As we're recording this now, there's a really interesting kind of storyline. So Stereophonics played a show a couple of nights ago, and there was a large audience there. They've received a lot of criticism for doing the show.
Yeah.
But at the same time, that was exactly when Boris Johnson and the government were saying, no, you should carry on going to large-scale events.
Yeah.
So, like, it's they're in kind of no man's land in that situation. So what's your...
And now, by not making it mandatory for pubs to close, he's preventing any insurance liability, I believe, anyway, so far. It's early news so far. And anyone who does go to the pub or you know, embraces anyone in public will be a social outcast. I don't like his tactics, if I'm honest, but you know, that's obviously not the purpose of what we're here to do today.
It's fine, we can slag off Boris. I've got no problem with that.
Good,
at all.
He's a fucking bastard.
I didn't appreciate that.
Lump of uncooked pastry.
Well, it's interesting because, he did say, so the wording of his statement was interesting. He didn't say we're shutting anywhere.
No.
He said he was recommending people don't go to these places. And you think there's a benefit to insurance companies out that way? Or
I think so, yeah. And he's, excuse the pun, but he's washing his hands of the responsibility of you have to close, so, thus making it, you know, important for everyone else to take the leadership, because he isn't giving any leadership at the moment, I don't think. And it's just not very nice to wake up every morning and think, right, what's going to be cancelled? Because every single day I have things taken out of my diary, and you know, all my friends do as well.
So as we record this, you're due to be playing, so Noel Gallagher's band, High Flying Birds, who you play with, are due to be playing at Glastonbury in June, which is the 50th anniversary, and I guess there's a risk around that.
I read that it's 16 weeks away. I'm not an expert on what this virus, the lifespan of this virus, but yeah. I'm getting a feeling that from what I have read that it's going to be around for quite some time. Mm. When the government talks in terms of, you know, people over 70 will have to self isolate for a very long time. I don't think they mean a month or two. I really hope that stays open, because the amount of people who will lose work, and it's apart from the fact that it's an amazing event, and I think it's right not to immediately start cancelling things in June. Mm. But you know, I've got a tour in May to America that is looking sketchy. So I think the 20th of May we're supposed to go to the States. It's just fingers crossed all the time, thinking which gig is going to happen, which gig is going to get cancelled, because everything has just been wiped out.
Often great art comes from crises, so maybe over the next, you know, few months some great music will be written, and maybe, you know, who knows, it's a really, really difficult time. And, you know, as we record this, you're due to be rehearsing tomorrow for Noel Gallagher.
That's right, yeah.
Those kind of gigs, so tell us about those gigs. So I think it's the two Teenage Cancer Trust gigs and some... Oh, so one of those and playing in Manchester as well.
There are two at the Apollo in Manchester on... supposed to be next week, I think. I can't remember the actual dates, but yeah, we were supposed to be rehearsing for the rest of this week over in Wandsworth, and we got a message on, I think it was Saturday, maybe Sunday, saying, do not travel, don't go to London, because a lot of the band live up north. Mm. And you know, people coming from all over the place. So yeah, the management said, put your brakes on. Mm. do not pass go, do not collect 200. And so that's a great shame, because it would have been part of the fact we haven't seen each other for quite some time. The last gig I did was in Bangkok in November last year.
Mm. And with a show like that, is that quite easy for you from your position to slip into? I mean, is there, with the parts you're playing, I mean, is it all written down in front of you so you can?
It is.
Do you need to rehearse? Could you have done it without rehearsal?
There's always no, because we always forget something, and Noel will look around and give us the devil eyes and say, "Where were you?" You know, and in fact, that happened.
The big eyebrow gets the big eyebrow. Yeah.
You don't want that eyebrow in your face. Yeah. And he'll say, "Where were you? You know, you're supposed to be playing." And but that's the new bit of whatever. And so, every now and again it happens. But we've got a fail-safe-ish method of, you know, we've got iPads on stage and we've got everything pretty, well, finessed, I suppose, whether we actually...
And would you, and you don't have to share set lists and stuff like that, obviously I know it's delicate subjects to some, do you know what your parts are going to be for the next shows, or
would you turn up and be like, right, okay, we're going to try this out and we'd like to write a part here and then?
Now, I mean, sometimes, you know, Noel will say, actually, could you, you know, Steve or Al White, who's the trombone player, can you figure out something for this tune, you know, maybe in the chorus or in the bridge or something, and we'll play something and maybe take away and write something down or just play something just in front of him. And he likes to know what's coming, so it'll be quite defined, I think, by the time you get on the stage and actually perform it. And typically on a tour, if we get the luxury of doing a sound check, we'll run. Yeah, he loves quite a long sound check.
Yeah, I've been to one of his sound checks, like 45 minute set.
Yeah,
it's great.
I call it a poorly attended matinee.
Why is that? Does he need to know that everything is in his right place?
What he's doing is using a tour quite smartly to rehearse the new tunes. You know, if he's releasing EPs you know, wants to integrate something into the set to muscle some of the other older stuff out. I don't know that that's his MO, but you know, but it works because you know you do that a few days and then let's play that will suddenly appear in not the just the sound check list, but in the actual gig list. It's quite likely that you might say actually, you know, because basically we're just standing there looking boring, and why not get us to play on something? So that's what can happen, you know.
What gigs with Noel have been highlights for you?
I've got to say the supporting U2 when we were in, we did a month in Europe and then a month in South America. They were pretty special. It was amazing. Just the whole vibe, the whole scale of it. So I think, you know, I'm not certain about this, but it seemed like about 300 crew.
Really?
And the best catering on earth.
Really?
Yeah.
STC, straight to catering. That's
that's
the Mikey Rowe thing.
Definitely do not pass go. Just go there. It was really good. Yeah, we all seriously need to lose weight after that.
How did the experience differ being like the opening band? Was that a bit strange for you, or was that, did it not really matter what time you went on stage?
I mean, without sort of putting myself down, the fact is that I'm a saxophone player in a horn section. We're not centre stage, never have been in that band. Very often aren't in any band. So honestly, it doesn't impact on us very much. You know, the crowd was vast still for Noel. You know, and quite a lot of them were there for him. But it didn't make too much difference for us. I know it would for Noel and for the rest of the band, who are slightly more kind of involved in the actual, yeah, that they're a bit more on show. And we come in, because we only play for about, on that tour, we only play for about 5 or 6 tunes a night. In fact, we were in, so one time in Paris, we were actually back at the hotel before the gig finished, before Noel actually came off stage, because we just played in the first like 4 or 5 tunes.
Oh, right. And then he was finished off.
Yeah,
and it was only
about a 10-minute drive and we got vroomed. Viano waiting.
Nice.
Yeah, early bath.
And did you tour with U2? Like, as in, did you travel with the band, U2 as well, or was it all kept very separate and you just do...
Well, they have their own... planes and, you know, planets, I think, as well. It's very separate. It's very, very separate. A couple of times, you know, you'd cross paths in the hotel lobbies and stuff. But, you know, even then, they'll be in different hotels very often, or just flying home in their jets to south of France. But, yeah, a few parties as well, which were good. Really good fun.
No expense spared. I'd imagine one question I'd actually ask a lot of guests is, and it's interesting from a saxophonist perspective, you talked about sound checks. What is it that you want in your monitors that makes you happy at a Noel gig? What is it that you need that you can go, right, that's my sound check, I'm ready?
I think it's not specific to any particular gig. I think you need to be able to hear you and your trumpet player and your trombone player if you're in a horn section. Nice balance between those three. You need to hear some time going on, and as little as you possibly can of everything else, just because it's clutter. And you know, guitars are like our worst enemy because it uses up the same sonic space as a sax. You know, they cut through. And I mean, Gem Archer is not exactly the quietest, but well, Noel isn't either.
No, I was gonna say.
Phenomenally loud. And there have been occasions where, not necessarily in that band, but others, that we've had Perspex screens and stuff put up, which, to be honest, does absolutely nothing.
Really?
You could, if you put maybe about five mattresses between, because I'm typically right behind the guitar stack, on, you know, on a riser, but the damage is there, coming right into my face.
Yeah.
But, you know, we all tend to use in-ears, so yeah. That... a bit of a safety measure, but
and
yeah,
that can,
in answer
and that
to your
can question, be tailored. The in-ears can be tailored to you, right?
So you just have whatever you want you ask for, and hopefully, touch wood, the sound man will give it to you. So yeah, but you just want to be able to hear yourself for tuning, because you know those outside gigs, it could be range between, you know, about 15 degrees difference from night to night, and a big hunk of metal around your neck. The tuning really goes if you can't hear yourself well, you know. So you have to sort of constantly adjust.
So last time I saw you, you're quite drunk. Uh-oh. When you told me this story, so we might not be able to put this in. But I just heard a live version of Wandering Star that day.
Oh yeah.
And like the brass on it sounded great, and you went, "Oh yeah, I think I wrote the part in the studio around that."
Yeah, that's yeah.
Do you remember that?
I can't.
But it's not on the record anymore, is it? Like, so the Wandering Star.
It's not. No. No. Well, there's an example of where Noel will say.
So how did that? So you in the studio with him?
Well,
already?
we were in.
Is it Rack Studios?
No, it wasn't a recording studio. It was the place. What's it called? SW19, and I think it was there. Yeah, pretty certain it was, and I can't remember what we were rehearsing for, but. He had some backing singers in who were doing this little motif kind of thing at the beginning. And he said, guys, it actually was quite embarrassing because he said, Steve, can you horn guys do that as well? And I had taken my ears out and I was probably playing on my phone or looking out the window, staring at something. And everyone in the whole room could see that Noel was talking to me, but I had no knowledge. And eventually I think somebody... Chris might have thrown a stick at me or something. Wake up, get in the room, you know. But he said, could you knock something together for that? So I did. And then...
You said, can I do it overnight? Is that right?
Yeah, I think... maybe I was hungover or something.
You're like, can I write it and I'm going to bring it in tomorrow?
Yeah, I think I did, yeah. You've got a great memory.
Yeah.
And, I think he was a bit... He thought, why don't you do it now? I thought,
yeah, that's what it is.
Yes, yeah.
It's some choice language, yeah.
So anyway, we did that.
It's all coming back now.
Got away with it. Yeah. But yeah, I think we did that. I think we played it a couple of times. We did it on Jules Holland. But yeah, it
sounded great on Jules Holland. That was
yeah,
good.
I quite like it. It's quite a meaty.
Yeah,
it's quite anthemic little bit, you know.
And did you play on any of the other EPs?
No,
just that track.
No, I think we were going to, but something happened and. I think Noel went away or something, but no, we didn't end up playing on any of them. So
I'd also like to talk to you about the national anthem.
Yeah,
what a fucking tune that is! Like, that's a song close to my heart. Like,
it's big,
seriously,
isn't it?
It is very big. I'd like you to talk because you actually went and recorded that in the studios. They're in like a barn. Somewhere.
Yeah, near in Oxfordshire. What begins with an A? I can't remember.
Abingdon.
There you are.
Yeah. So. Tell us about that, and because it's a very interesting part, isn't it? It's crazy that the brass on that is just all over the place, but it's amazing.
It's random, sort of organised chaos, yeah. And then disorganised again, and then made more chaotic. Johnny Greenwood sent... Well, an old friend of mine, Andy Bush, who was a trumpet player, and I was in a horn section with him... He teaches at Abingdon School, and he was asked through the teaching staff there, you know, if he might be in, if they could put him in touch with Johnny Greenwood. So
what?
It's bizarre.
What a
I know
call.
It's a bit.
Well, they needed some brass. They just went, let's call the local school.
Well, they did because they've got you know that's
yeah
that's that was their kind of HQ, I suppose, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, wow.
You know? And so and Andy phoned me up and said, do you fancy doing this Radiohead thing? I thought, yeah, massively. And so it was the time when faxes, you know, and I found it the other day, actually, because I was showing my son, because he was a massive Radiohead fan. Mm. And I showed this random part, and I looked at it and thought, I could see where it's, I could see it.
Who wrote the part? Johnny?
Johnny, yeah. It was on Logic. I think it was a Logic part. But it just had a couple of saxophones playing chords and the baritone, you know, doing what it does at the bottom. And so, yeah, we got eight people together to go up there. And very soon after we started, apart from the fact that we got there and they were all kind of in their dressing gowns and they were coming down from their, you know, late nights and stuff. And, hello, yeah, hi, I'm Steve, you know, nervously. And we got a sound together with Nigel. And,
Godrich.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Right.
And it was a very relaxed vibe, you know, all, I think in a semicircle, so we could sort of see each other a little bit. And I've heard since that he wanted it to, that Tom York wanted it to sound like a traffic jam. But I didn't know that at the time. But that, you know, it's right. One of the, I don't know if it's a spin on that somebody's put on or whatever. But it kind of does. Mm-hmm. It's very sort of honky. And we did about maybe five, six, could have been 10 takes of the same thing. And he was just absolutely covered in sweat by the end of it, Tom, because he was in front of us in this semicircle type thing. Jumping up and down, and allegedly broke his foot doing that.
Oh, right. Yeah, I think that.
And again, that we weren't privy to that.
So he was jumping up and down to create the energy.
So, yeah, exactly. So he was kind of conducting, and it worked, because you could feel a bit, you could feel like everyone's, you know, having some sort of fit, because there's a lot of energy in the room, and there was. And actually, the temperature sort of rose quite a lot. You know?
Yeah.
It was a bit strange.
How were you? Because that was obviously psychologically intended to impact your performance in
create,
some way.
Create a musical urgency that I guess which it did.
Yeah.
And we did have parts, but we didn't really adhere to them. You know, and we'd go for lunch, and you know. Which was a nice thing as well, because they had decent caterers and a couple of bottles of wine.
There's a theme here. Yeah. So we just had dinner before this as well. So.
I think of nothing but my stomach.
So they looked after
you. Had a lovely dinner before, yeah. But I've got to say, I didn't mention that before. Yeah. Delicious.
Good. Right, so...
It was just a chaotic cacophony of row. And then they spliced at the end. I think it was all in one take, and then they spliced on the end chord. And... which is like, bah! And then that's it.
So when you then went and toured with them and played that live, because it was a bit messy, was it hard to work out exactly what everyone had played or work out the parts, or was it just a case of...
Well, they didn't care. They didn't really care whether it sounded exactly like... It was all for an effect.
Right.
And I'm not really sure if we ever got quite that intensity again, but we only did a handful of gigs.
You did Jules Holland, right? The live...
We did, yeah. I think... REM and Radiohead are the only two bands at that stage to have had the whole show to themselves.
Yeah, I remember watching it.
And
so what did you play on that Just National Anthem?
That's all we ever played, yeah.
So you went on tour just playing one song?
Well, I mean, we didn't really go on tour. We went to Paris to do Canal Plus. We went we did something at Air Studios, a live album of it. But I'm pretty certain we only played that tune, because we weren't on any of the other tracks.
Because I wonder, because on the same recording sessions, that's when Humphrey Littleton...
That's right, yeah.
He did Life in a Glass House, which appeared on Amnesiac.
Yeah, and Jimmy Hastings on clarinet.
Right, is that right? Yeah, okay, yeah. But you didn't get a chance to play those parts?
No, we didn't. Okay. Unfortunately, no. Yeah, no, but yeah, he was there, Humph, yeah.
What was it like? I mean, it's such a vague question, but what was it like being on tour briefly with Radiohead? How did that? Okay, here's a question. How does it differ being on tour with Radiohead to Noel Gallagher's High Flying Birds?
Both very disciplined bands. I very, very, very well behaved at sound checks. I hate people noodling around and, you know, mucking, practicing. And Radiohead is possibly, I don't know if this is a fact, but I'm going to say it's a fact. Radiohead, I would say, is the most disciplined band I've ever, that it is in the world. And because you never, ever hear anyone tinkling along or, you know, nothing. And so when you get told, right, play the alto, you play it, and then stop, that's it. And it's just silent. And that you could hear a pin drop. And that's what a soundtrack should be like. And Noel's band, similar, maybe not quite as well-behaved. but, you know, back in the day when everyone had monitors, it could be chaos. Because the guitar player will never shut up, generally. I'm not talking about Noel.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, when I used to do Blur in the sort of late 90s, that was always a noisy soundcheck. Not that we often soundcheck, but...
So what Blur tracks did you do live?
Oh, blimey. I mean,
End of the Century, that's got brass on it.
Yeah.
Did you found that, did you? Oh, nice.
Yeah. I did an American tour with them, a couple of European tours, lots of festivals. But that was a long time ago. That's over 20 years ago. I think the last one I did was 99.
You've been a constant in some of the biggest bands in British music. I don't think you realise that. I mean, like, you know, you're a jazz player and you've got your own stuff on that. But it's really interesting you've got this perspective from, you know, all these different bands that have changed a lot of people's lives in the UK.
Well, yeah. I mean, and fortunately, I like them as well. I like that sort of... I mean, Radiohead, I've got to say, is just gives me goosebumps. Not everything, but I love the sound. When did they last do Glastonbury? I watched that and
it was... 2018, I was there.
Yeah, it was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I mentioned earlier to you, so I was on holiday last week, very luckily, with Clive Dima, who's Radiohead's live drummer now, and has been on the podcast before, and he was saying that from their perspective, that was like an absolute shit gig. Like, the sound was terrible. Everything went wrong. Like, but their way of keeping in the zone of like, okay, we think this is going well, was reading the faces of the people in the first few rows.
Really?
And they're like, oh, obviously this is going well. But from their perspective, it was like, ah, this was all going, like, didn't enjoy it. Which is mad, because it was from the other side of the fence, fucking...
It's incredible. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Great band. And you two played with us, like, you know, that's amazing. Let's talk about, because we talked about, say, we go Radiohead, you've got the Noel Gallagher thing, you've got Blur there. There's kind of a link to Queen as well, because your father-in-law was in Queen for 3 years.
I bet you can't say that without laughing.
So, regular listeners to the podcast, Jamie Moses, who it's such an extensive career, we had to do two episodes, was on, and that is Stephen's father-in-law. And you're in a band with him as well, right? You play quite a lot of shows with him.
Well, I know this sounds dodgy, but I've known him for at least 10 years longer than I've known his daughter.
Which is an interesting dynamic.
Yes. So, we were in a band, well, we still are in a band, the longest surviving band of all time, I think it is.
SAS.
The SAS band, yeah.
Yeah, which is Spike, who's also been on the podcast, Spike from Queen, does like an all-stars band, right?
Yeah,
and you get lots of different, and you're the kind of house band, if you like, in the background, get lots of different artists coming up on stage. Yeah. It's an amazing thing. Tell us about how you manage being in a band, because we, you know, look at Noel Edwards being in a band with his brother for years, and there's always an interesting dynamic. I wonder how many people have been in a band with their father-in-law. I think that, like, Meet the Fockers. It's like all the things that go wrong. And yes, you knew Jamie beforehand, but how do you compartmentalize that dynamic between a bandmate and possibly someone who may be at times band leader telling you what to do with being your...
I really try not to think about it.
It's a weird one, isn't it?
It's...
What advice would you give to someone in that situation to keep that relationship professional and family? Like, it's such a struggle.
Leave the band. Well, I mean, we're mates, but, you know, it's... He's not a regular father-in-law, you know. He's a character. He's a dude, and he's very funny. And we just have a laugh, you know. I mean, there isn't a father-in-law, son-in-law vibe. I hope not in my eyes, anyway.
How did he
likes to be called Phil, father-in-law.
Oh, was he okay with it? I mean, when like
no. Well, we discovered through his brother Steve Moses that when he first found out about it, he was absolutely horrified.
Why?
Well, because
of you.
Because he. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't want my daughter to go out with me. I've got a daughter though.
No, but it's just an interesting dynamic, like how you keep that relationship. Like, have there been times where a band disagreement has then bled into?
Not so far. But no, we'll work on that.
Good. Yeah. It's an interesting dynamic.
We survived Christmas. I think we can survive anything.
Yeah. sensible approach, sensible thinking. Let's talk about some of the other amazing things you've done. I mean, Tina Turner. Did you play on
I played on a couple of her records. I've never met her. I've got to say this, so I can't.
No, that's
tell
fine.
The story. But there was a remake of Nutbush City Limits. I think back really early, maybe 1990 or 91. It was the remake, but not speeding up, because I think the original sped up about 30 beats per minute.
Really? I didn't know that, right.
Yeah. If you listen to it, it's really, it really starts slow and it hammers on. So did that and a bit of a, I think there was a club mix of that as well.
And then so what was the remit for that? That was just someone sending it across, and did it remotely? Or?
No, it was at Psalm Studios, I think. That's a long time ago, so I think it was down at Psalm. And I think just three horns, pretty much shadowing what was done before, so there was nothing sort of major breakthrough there. And then we did another track on called Confidential. I think Neil Tennant from the Pet Shop Boys wrote that.
Or wrote the song, or wrote the part?
Wrote the song.
Oh, nice.
And that was a four-piece, I think. I think I was playing baritone. I borrowed a baritone sax, because I didn't have one at the time for that. And, I remember it kind of slightly falling apart in the middle of the session. But that's quite a nice tune. It's quite a nice arrangement, of Neil Tennant. We also did the Pet Shop Boys album,
really?
I think. It's called Yes, yeah.
That right.
About... 8 or 9 years ago, I bumped into Neil Tennant, who I didn't really meet at the session, and I said, "Oh, by the way, I'm Steve, and this is Joe and Mike. You know, we played on your album, Yes." And he just said, "Yeah," and that was it. You could edit that out.
Oh, that's a shame. Wow. Okay, that's interesting. Got,
yeah, there was no small talk to be had.
There's no small talk to be had. Do you know, one track that, when I messaged you the other day, I don't know if you get the significance of, you played on a track that's quite an interesting track called Since I Told You It Was Over. No, hang on. Hang on. Since I Told You...
That sounds about right.
I'm going to edit this bit out. Since I Told You It's Over... Yeah. So another track that's really interesting that you played on is called Since I Told You It's Over. And the reason, it's a Stereophonic song of, I think, their fourth album. But I don't know if you realise that's quite a heavy deal, because it's the last track that Stuart Cable, the drummer, played on. Are you aware of that?
Well, I remember him being there. We did that at Abbey Road. And I remember the smell of weed.
Right.
I mean, I'm used to it. I'm a musician. Yeah. But it was... incredible, yeah. I didn't know that, though. I really didn't know that.
So, that was the last track he played on, and it's like such a sad story what happened to him. So for listeners who don't know, he's a drummer band called Stereophonics. Their first three albums are absolutely great. They're a great band. Like, school friends, did these, you know, big tours, big albums, and unfortunately he was sacked by the band, which, when they played kind of like hometown shows thereafter, he said he went to Cardiff and saw them play to 80,000 people. And he said, he said it in a book later on, he said, "I can never imagine in the past someone who was so sad they'd want to take their life. But on that night, I could understand it." He didn't take his life, but then the next tour, the same night they were in Cardiff, they played, he drank himself through till 5 o'clock in the morning, never woke up. Like, it's a very, very sad story.
Yeah.
What do you remember of playing that track or playing the theme? Obviously, the smell, and he was having a good time. But like, what could you tell us about? Like, do you remember much about that?
I remember. It's funny when you. It's lovely to leave a studio thinking that was really meaty and not just meaty. You know, a horn section could be quite diverse in the sound approach. But I remember leaving there thinking that was a really thin sound and I didn't really like it. I need to reacquaint myself with the track, but
yeah,
I think I listened to it when it first came out and it wasn't, I don't know, it was just too thin. There was no sort of muscle. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I totally know what you mean. Yeah. But it doesn't sound like that. I'll listen to it this weekend. It sounds great.
And if I'd arranged that, or you know, contemporaries of mine arranged that, I think it would have been a bit more fulsome. But then again, it had a bit of lightness to it. But it's, yeah, just, I remember feeling that, yeah, a bit thin. You know,
Did you bump into Tom York in that session?
Yes. Well, I went into the cafe. Yeah, this is quite funny, actually. Because actually, I hadn't sort of qualified by, you know, when we did a few of those things with Radiohead back in 99, we went to New York and did Saturday Night Live and stuff. And whenever we turned up there, you know, we'd do a gig at the Roseland Ballroom in New York, and their band would go, "Oh, thanks, thank you so much for coming." We're like fawning over us, and like, "Well, it's all right. We don't mind." And made us almost feel uncomfortable for our imagined generosity of time, you know.
Oh, no.
And they so they were saying, "Oh, it's so lovely, thank you so much." And when we were in at Canal Plus, they gave us platinum discs, which was amazing. And said, "Thank you so much for playing on our album." So no, that's all right, thanks Tom, you know.
Really?
And yeah, and then so that's the background. And it was quite embarrassing that they kept kind of fawning over us and saying, "Oh, wonderful, wonderful." And walked into the cafe after this stereophonic session, and Tom and Nigel were in there. I think Johnny, and Johnny. And I said, "Oh, hi guys." And I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "Well, we're up in the penthouse mastering our album, or mixing our new album." And I said, "Are there any horns on it?" He said, "Fuck off, you lot were a load of, you were a nightmare, you lot, to work with."
Really?
Absolute fucking nightmare, not having any horns on it. And it was like, what? You can't.
Shit. Was he joking or was
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he was, but I hadn't.
Yeah, wow.
But it was bizarre that he kind of said, because it was, they were laying it on so thick, you know, that how wonderful it was to have us all there. But, I mean, I can imagine he's right the second time that it's an absolute nightmare to have eight idiot horn players.
Well, is it just because he obviously kind of produced you in that moment? What was Godrich's role? Because I mean, there's such an interesting relationship between Nigel Godrich and Radiohead.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I wonder, they obviously trust him so much. So, what do you remember going back to the National Anthem when you did record with them? Of Godrich, was he just kind of letting Tom do his thing, or?
It's difficult to know to really give a comprehensive answer to that. Having sort of, I mean, we spent a whole day with him with the band. For one track, I mean, it was, you know, it was quite an odd thing to, you know, most bands want you to get out, but they really wanted to explore the sound and the level of chaos that they could get out of eight players, which is quite a lot, by the way.
Yeah.
And they, so I think they wanted to, you know, they got their money's worth for the day, but it's difficult for me to say just in one experience. I mean, Nigel was the dude definitely at the beginning who said, "Right, you stand there, get obviously finding what sounds nice in the room, and you know what microphones he's going to use." And I think there was a bit of moving around and you know just getting it so that it sounded. And I can't remember, but I think we may have been individually mic'd, definitely a stereo pair in the room. But yeah, he was in charge, and then Tom kind of came in to you know put the gloss on it. That's my impression of it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, because they super trust him. There's, you know, even now they work with him all the time.
Yeah.
Let's quickly discuss a particular show that you did, or a series of shows that you did that ended up meaning that you played with Stevie Wonder, Beyonce,
yeah.
Aretha Franklin as well.
Yeah,
is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Tell us about those shows.
Well, it was Nelson Mandela's charity 4664. With the SAS band, we were hired in some bemusement to be the backing band basically for all these stars. Queen were doing it. Bono and The Edge were involved. Beyonce and it was four gigs that we did. One Cape Town, one Johannesburg, one in New York, and one in Hyde Park. And it was basically everyone who's ever sung a song. Amy Winehouse came along.
Really?
She did the Hyde Park one. Beyonce and Bono did a tune that we put some horns on.
Were there rehearsals?
We were there for about, I think, 2 or 3 weeks before the gig.
With the artist did rehearsal
as well. So it was a staggered rehearsal. So, you know, people would come in and rehearse. I don't think Beyonce came into the studio. I think we just rehearsed with her on stage the night before. But that was the Cape Town one.
And you also played with Stevie Wonder at Radio City Music Hall.
Yeah, we did. Kind of by accident a little bit. We were, as I said, we were backing all the visiting artists. Aretha Franklin was there, and she was rumoured to have had her own band, but then it was revealed to us that they hadn't got any horns, so would we sit in with her?
How long before the gig did you find that out?
I think, kind of at the sound check, the way these parts were given to us, but they were all in the wrong key.
Oh, my God. Is that a nightmare, or are you like, oh, that's okay, we got this covered? Like, is that a bit of a horror situation?
It was... Obviously, I think you sort of rise to it. If Aretha for me is that's it doesn't get any better. It's even at that, you know, she wasn't in the fantastic prime of her life singing wise, but the voice, it just rips your head off. You know, I have goosebumps thinking about it.
So they gave you the parts what on paper?
Yeah, just on paper, old steam, you know, old style, old school. And
what song was it? Can you remember?
I've got to admit that I nicked my part. And I'll find it and get back to you on that. But I can't remember what
it
was.
So it wasn't a hit? It wasn't?
No, it wasn't yeah. Respect. Because I had fantasies about them saying, let's do Respect and Steve, do the tenor solo. and then me retiring into the sunset.
she played this show and just like knocked out like a new track and like no.
Well,
like,
no, it was an old tune. I can't remember what it was. It was quite
B-side.
A B-side. It was a real down tune, but then the MD who I can't remember his name, but he just said, let's do tabs. So 3-4. What? So and when you say do stab, so the horns do a stab, and you'll cup your hand like well, this is. Doesn't work for this, but, as if you're holding a mug, which means the key of C.
Really?
So the guy did this, but it wasn't in C at all. It was in C sharp.
Oh,
so
fuck.
We all came in, went big blat of C, bap bap, and the first one obviously was in the wrong key, and there was none of us really ever sussed out whether he was doing that deliberately. Because, you know...
For effect or...
Yeah, and if it's in A, you'll put three fingers up, which means three sharps.
Nice.
Three fingers down is E-flat, C-flat. So, you know...
That's the code.
But he went C, definitely C, and we came...
So what would the sign have been for C-sharp then? So you got the C cup, what would
it be seven sharps, which, maybe he only had one hand.
Oh, wow. Oh, so, yeah, that...
Actually, I never saw his left hand.
Yeah.
The urban myth.
Wow. And Stevie Wonder. How did
Stevie Wonder? Well, Nathan Watts. They were rehearsing. They were kind of slunk in. These really cool guys, and the percussionist was brilliant. There's a second keyboard player. They were just absolutely shredding away, you know, in the background. And then I think he played Spain Chick Corea tune, just you know, all over the place, and then. It was for Nelson Mandela's 90th or 91st birthday.
Was he there?
That was the only one he wasn't at, actually. Right. He did a video link, I think. But so obviously they're going to play Happy Birthday. So we went up to Nathan Watts, his MD, and said, "Do you mind if should we play? You know, because there's no other horns there." He said, "Yeah, it'd be brilliant, man, brilliant." So we sort of hashed together a part, you know, and did a quick arrangement. Well, you know. Tried to make it sound as good as we possibly could in the 10 minutes that we had, and then did that.
What was he was on the video link, or was it pre-recorded?
No. I mean, you know, that was at the sound check.
Oh, okay.
So then we thought, right, great, we're going to play with Stevie. You know, so everyone, every musician's absolute dream. You know, and anyway, that all ended, and we played with. God, I mean, so many people that night. It was incredible. And then I'm on stage, and this guy, everyone comes down to the front and sort of takes a bow. And this guy from behind says, "Great gig, man, great gig." And I feel this presence of a sort of godly person, and he put his arms around me, and I was being hugged by Morgan Freeman.
No,
yeah,
fucking
and
way.
Nobody had a fucking camera.
Wow, fucking
and,
hell, man.
And he introduced me to his mate Tim Robbins.
Shut up. They were in the Shawshank Redemption for a moment.
I know this is the clang of all fucking clangs.
What?
But
really?
I was. And then the same evening
they
I
should be living on a beach in Mexico.
I think they should have been, yeah.
You. Wow.
So I couldn't speak. I mean, you know, I stutter quite a lot anyway. But, you know, and his voice just melts. You know, it's like. Voice like a sofa.
Yeah. Should you, Tim Robbins?
Yeah.
Andy Dufresne was there. And Red from Shawshank Redemption.
And Nicolas Sarkozy.
Really?
I said to him, he was in the wings because his wife was singing something.
Yeah, wow.
And I said to him, bonjour. He said, no, bonsoir. So I get a French grammar lesson as well from the French president. I'm talking to... So wow. That's the clang of all clangs. Yeah, so meeting Morgan Freeman, I think, because, you know, we meet musicians all the time with various levels, degrees of impressed by them. But, you know, someone like that absolutely blew me away. So that was a great night. And then we went and got drunk.
I bet you did.
Excessively.
You once said to me, right, again, you might have been a bit drunk at the time. I said
You're
to you...
You're painting a dark picture of me.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, I was like, as a failed musician, I always wanted to walk on stage at Shepherd's Empire and just see the view from that perspective. So it's one of the venues, the first place I ever went to. And you went, Chris, you can do whatever you want in life. And you gave me your pass and I walked out there. And you had this, you kept saying this thing, Chris, you can do whatever you want in life.
Now, you I vaguely remember that. No,
yeah.
I didn't. Yeah.
And I've got a great photo on the stage in an empty Shepherd's Bush Empire. It was great. Where does that come from? You can do anything in life. Where is that? Is that a motto of yours, or is that something that you...
Well, you can, and you did. Anyone can do... I mean, you know, we all have this imposter syndrome in various degrees as well, don't we? That you know, and in many bands that I've been... in and I thought, well, I know for a fact there are loads of better saxophone players than me, but you know, I've been lucky enough or whatever to have been employed by a lot of bands over the years, and I've always, you know, I'm sure many session musicians would think this, you know, what am I doing here? Why isn't someone else doing it?
What is it about you then? So if it's not just around the actual hard skills of your actual, and you are obviously a brilliant saxophone player, but what are the skills that you think that might not be so obvious in regards to your musicianship that's allowed you to be in that position?
Well, I think keeping your ears open and knowing what's going on around you and not just doing what you do. And there are lots of players who do that, just turn up and be, you know, Fred Bloggs, whatever. And not actually be sensitive to what they're playing. And that's, I mean, trumpet players, a lot of trumpet players like that, who just go, ah! You know, and you say, well, don't do that. You know, listen to, have a bit of context, musical context. And you have to have a musical intelligence about you, regardless of how well you can play. You just be aware of what's going on and sensitive to, I guess. But you know, also, when I went to music college back before the beginning of time, and I remember my teacher, John Hall, who was a brilliant, amazing saxophone player, but a classical saxophone player. And he said, "Steve, what do you want to do when you get out of here? You know, like when you get out of prison kind of thing." And I said, I want to be in rock bands, I want to be in pop bands, rock bands. He said, "Well, you're never going to do that." And I thought, yes, I fucking am. And it enraged me that he'd said that, because I knew that that's what I was going to do. And I don't like being told that I can't do something. So in answer to your question...
Shit, yeah.
In answer to your question, you know, why can you do anything you want? Because you can, because you fucking well can. And...
Did you ever find out what he meant by... Was he saying you can't do that because there's not many saxophone parts, if you like, in pop music or rock music, as you said it at the time? Or was it on your technique? Was it you personally? Why do you think he said you can't do it?
Well, I don't know.
Was he setting your expectations?
I think he had... He was very inspirational, and also the opposite of inspirational at the same time. It's a curious kind of relationship. You know, he would leave me a message in the cubby, you know, the pigeonholes at music college, say meet me in the pub, instead of having a lesson and have 3 pints with him. I don't know what his issue was really, but he certainly wasn't. He was trying to. He succeeded because he told me something that, and I rebelled against it and said, "Thought."
So what? Which that might have been planned.
Could have been. I never asked him, because I don't think I ever went to any lessons after that.
It's interesting because you do hear a lot of stories like that, and you wonder, maybe in retrospect it was a bit of wisdom, where it was like, I've sussed out this character, I'm going to tell him he can't do that.
Well, it's a psychology that works, has worked throughout history, and obviously worked. You know, it may have had an impact on me. I'm not sure, but I remember little bites of information that people give me. You know, like my other teacher, Steve Trier, who, when I was at college, he was like a dad figure to me. In fact, he's a dad figure to all the students. He's amazing, beautiful bloke. And he said, don't practice till you get it right. Practice till you can't get it wrong.
Mm.
And I think about that every day. I don't necessarily adhere to it. But, you know, my son Ted plays the saxophone as well. He's a 17-year-old boy now. And I always bang that into his head, that phrase, you know, don't just play it till you get it right. Keep play it so it's impossible.
Muscle
to get
memory,
it
and you just can't.
Yeah,
get it
yeah,
right.
Muscle memory, exactly. Yeah.
But with that, with obviously, you know, your music derives from kind of a jazz background, which is very loose and very, you know, you have to be very adaptable and that kind of thing. So, how do you find yourself in jazz setting? I mean, obviously, you're a fucking great jazz player, and your whole album is jazz. But like, what's the contrast there in comparison?
Well, the thing is, I'm a jazz fan. I'm not a jazz player. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love jazz. I love really, really good jazz. But, you know, all my friends, you know, I would never, ever class myself as a jazz player. I'm between the cracks of lots of things.
Mm.
I've listened to lots of soul, you know, Otis Redding. I mean, I would love to have been able to play the sax like he sings.
Nice.
You know, just because it's Marvin Gaye. I mean, the sound, the timing, everything about it is pretty perfection as far as I'm concerned. I'm not into the big, massive solos, despite what you might think of having listened to the album. You know, the sax is up there, but it's not.
No, it's not front and centre at all.
But,
yeah.
There's a bit of a story going on. You know, it sounds a horrible cliche, but it's a bit of interplay. Lots of interplay, actually. And what I did with that is, you know, I'd get somebody around, like Joe Auckland, amazing trumpet player, and he'd play a solo, and I'd transcribe it. Or the bits that are really melodic and...
Using what, Sibelius? Or would you do it on hand?
Well,
or?
I just put it into Logic and then just put it in, right, yeah. play it in. Or and then, you know, then get Trevor Myers in, who's a trombone player on the album. And we play the whole, or part of the solo in unison, in the middle of his solo. And I don't know if anyone really does that before. And then we got a couple of rappers in as well.
Yeah. So Shift the Paradigm is such a fucking tune. That's amazing,
yeah, thank
right?
Thank
you. So who's the rapper who performed on that?
Q-Rock.
Right, so Q-Rock. Yeah. Interesting dynamic here, because a lot of the album is instrumental, but then you've got kind of some vocals on it. Are they songs that you know what the lyrics are going to be about when you're doing the instrumental parts, or are the lyrics align to the music in any way? Like, what's the relationship between them? Or are they two separate things?
I think they're very, very much separate. I mean, I got a guy called Julian Brown, who's also known as JB Sparks,
yeah,
to rap on a couple of tunes as well. In fact, I'm doing some at the moment, and I think we've got a guy called Blade who's okay. going to join us. But what I do is sample some bit of rap from any record at the right BPM, put it onto my demo, and then send it to somebody and say, don't take any notice of what it is that they're, you know, the story or poem or whatever is going on. Just come up with something in those gaps and that, you know, just to give them a bit of geography. And
is it an instrumental version? So you're sending an instrumental version with something on top?
Yeah, so I'll send two versions, one with somebody sampled onto it. And I'll never say what it is, where I got it from or anything, but I'll probably know. But,
yeah.
And a clean track without any stuff so they can... And you know, both of them phoned me up and said, right, I'm doing it on my phone. And it was brilliant. And then they came over and recorded. I really enjoyed that because it adds so much.
So when you're writing a instrumental, is there a emotion? There is definitely an emotion behind it, obviously. But is there a chance there's going to be a clash in the theme or what you're thinking from the instrumental point of view and then what the lyrics happen to be about? Like, is there a marry-up of those two things? Do you explain, okay, this instrumental is about, this is where I'm coming from and it, can you write lyrics to that? Or is it just, you've heard it, what's your interpretation to write lyrics to?
Well, I had, with Colin Winter, also known as Q-Rock, he came up with all the lyrics on Shift the Paradigm. And I said to him, what do you want to call this? And he said, Belly of the Beast. And I, because I'm an arrogant asshole, I just thought, no, I like Shift the Paradigm, because that's another lyric in it.
Right.
But he was right and I'm wrong, because Belly of the Beast would have been so much better.
No, I disagree. Shift the Paradigm is a fucking great title.
But I don't know, I just thought, oh, that sounds really good. And then as soon as it was kind of pressed and printed, I thought, no, I was wrong there. But, you know, next time.
It's one of those things. So tell us about recording that record. So how long did it take? Was it at home? Was it in studio?
It was at my studio in my house, and also at a place called Press Play Studios, which is where I used to have a studio. A very interesting guy called The Reflex took over my studio. He's a remixer. He's done quite a lot of Noel's remixing.
Oh, right, okay.
A very cool French dude who is just... Yeah, yeah.
What's his name?
Nick, I don't know his second name, but I just call him Reflex. Begins with a P, Nick something. But
the guy who does YC's recording, French guy who he did the mixing on the previous Noel album, working with David Holmes.
No, I don't think it is. But
yeah, sorry, too many beers here. That's
can't tell. Yeah, but anyway, recorded some drums at Press Play Studios. A guy called Andy Ramsey, who's in Stereo Lab. I don't know if you know.
Oh yeah,
he's a drummer there, and I had a studio there for years. Recorded that, and then somebody recorded some guitar in Sweden, and you know, remote recording all over the place, really. But all the horns were done at my place.
Nice. Yeah. Happy with the outcome?
I love it. I love the sound of the sousaphone playing on the bass, because there's no bass guitar on it at all. It's all sousaphone.
Really?
Okay, yeah, right. Which is... So that's good that you didn't notice.
Well, no, I didn't, yeah. And there was one track that I was like, the bass is really interesting on this.
Yeah, it's a bit weird.
Yeah, it is a bit weird, yeah, yeah.
I've practiced a bit more how to record the sousaphone, because it's a bit of a beast.
Tell listeners what the sousaphone is.
Sousaphone is a huge instrument that you wrap around your head. blow into it's tuba-esque, I suppose, but and you see a lot of people in New Orleans cycling with a sousaphone still wrapped around them, and it's an instrument that's used to play the bass in Dixieland trad jazz bands, but it's got a bit of a lightness of touch, and there's something a little bit. Excuse all the sousaphone players there, but there's something a bit light and jovial about it.
Mm-hmm. I get that.
It's not it's not a dirty sort of thing, yeah. You know. But I just love the sound of it, and it's. But it's interesting you hadn't noticed that it was.
No, I noticed the bass was interesting sounding.
All the bass is sousaphone. Yeah.
Interesting. I was literally walking. I remember I was walking. I was like, "What's going on with the bass here? It's really interesting." Okay, that's cool. And so, I mean, we were talking about maybe playing live shows around the album launch and stuff. So we don't know exactly where that is at the moment, but we can. We'll keep listeners in the loop.
Well, there's going to be one. We were going to launch this album in on the 11th of April, but. I know we're doing a gig in October, but it'll be at the same festival, the Nunfest.
Yeah, in October.
Yeah, so in London. 17th of October. We'll hopefully have some shows over the summer, but
we'll keep
time. We'll tell if we're all alive. And...
So many good stories in there. That was part one of two with Steve Hamilton, and part two will be coming very soon. I mean Aretha Franklin, I mean all these great people that he's worked with, fantastic to listen to. So part two's coming next week. Also on top of that, as mentioned at the beginning, doing live coaching sessions now, specialising in well-being. Thought I'd open that up kind of internationally to our listeners as well, because we've got people all over the globe. So if you're interested in that, get in touch with us. I'm an emotional intelligence practitioner and a mental health first aider, and kind of just specialising in well-being, particularly around coronavirus. So if you're interested, get in touch with us at stageleftnights@gmail.com. That's stageleftnights@gmail.com. We'll have a new episode soon. It's actually the 5th anniversary of the podcast, so I'm deciding that I'm going to actually record a little special just with me, kind of with a few reflections of favourite episodes and stuff like that, as bonus content as well. Okay, so we'll see you soon for part two.